Everyone, welcome to Innov & Créa. I'm Anjali Vallée, and my guest today is David H. Clifford. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I think I'll start by saying that it's the first episode that I have a co-host. His name is Benny. It's a dog. It's my first dog. Right now, it's chewing on a toy, but we could be interrupted. So I just want to put it out there. If there is noises that I can't do something with in editing, it's the dog.
I'm curious, can I interrupt him on purpose so I can meet him? But we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
David.
Yes.
You are another multi-potentialite, which I tend to interview on this podcast. So I'll name a few things that you do and or are, depending on how you view it. Artist, maker, designer, edu-agitator. I like that. Founder of Design School X. Founder of East Bay School for Boys. Co-creator of Liberatory Design. You also have a wonderful TEDx about X-shaped people. We're going to talk about this as well. Very interesting episode. But first, the question I ask everybody, the rude question. When you were a young lad, 10, 12 years old, what were you fascinated about, interested, passionate about?
Okay, so when I was 10... Ooh, that would be third grade. So most kids, I think, are nine. I was held back because I was a runt. I was super small. I was super socially awkward and terrified of kids and people. I don't have it here, but I have a picture that's up on our wall and I share it all the time. And it's me actually at four. In a, you know, class picture, and it's beautiful because everyone has these beautiful smiles on their faces. And then there I am in the background. And I don't know why I'm in the back because I'm freaking tiny and everyone else is towering over me and they're all smiling. And I'm there like a deer in headlights, just like no expression. And just kind of staring into the camera. And that kind of sums up my time in school until about, high school. But so 10 or 11, I was, so there's a lot going on. My parents were in the process of a nasty divorce, which wasn't that cool because they kind of played us, you know, my sister and I, in their drama. So that was really what was weighing on my heart. I was super into snakes. Oh. I had a little garter snake. I was super into BMX. And I had this really cool club. It was really a club of one. And it was called FABS. And FABS, it stood for, excuse my language, but it was fuck. These are all the bad words that really excited me, but it was fuck, ass, bitch, and shit.
Whoa.
And so, right? And I was really into knives too. So I carved. I carved FABS, FABS, into this log. And that was the sign that I put outside my little clubhouse that only I went into. And the cats went in there to take their little rodents to kill. But I tried to get kids in the neighborhood to join, but it was a little too deviant, given those words. But that's what I was into. I was interesting thinking about that. I was interested in so many things. And now at 52, I'm still interested in so many different things. And it's, for a long time, I felt like there was something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. That I should focus on one thing. And now I've realized at around 48, 49, that it is what I need to do. I need to have all these things occupying my attention, as a way to get creativity out and to engage That's with the world.
So interesting. I feel the same way. And I've always find it fairly sad, but it was the times were like that, that I too felt like, well, so as a girl, you had to be a good girl and you had to be, you know, also the pressure of choosing one thing, being one thing for the rest of your life. I mean, it just brings anguish, anxiety. And it's only fairly recently that I too made peace with, well, there you go. I'm a multipotentialite. I love a bunch of stuff. They all feed each other. And all the drawers in my brains have to be open. Well, I close them when it's, I find out it's unnecessary. But yeah, a bunch of people just can't just be one thing, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting too. I think about this current generation. And again, I know I'm going to be generalizing here, but I feel, and I'm also going to sound old, but I feel like back in the day when it was multidisciplinary or there was multiple things to do, they were multiple things to do in a tangible way. Like you had to do them.
Yes.
And there were consequences. And I know that there's massive consequences now in the digital age, but it also took work to do the things that you actually had to go to the library to research something, or you had to go this place or that place to do the thing. And now I feel in modern multidisciplinary, it's a flick of a thumb.
And it was all experiences. There were experiential knowledge, I would say, when you had to go to the library, flip through the cards, the index cards, find the right thing. All this involves the body, involves movement, involves reading, pay attention, meeting other people. It was the same thing for going to the shop in high school. Some people liked it, some people didn't, or learning to stitch or sew or cook, or it involved the body.
Dude, I am. So I'm reading this book called The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain by Anne Murphy Paul.
I'll link it in the notes.
And the reason I'm reading it, it was suggested to me by a friend, David Wildcress. And he works a lot with 2E kids, so twice exceptional.
Yes.
And one of the things that's interesting to me right now is the intersection between ableism, or the connection between ableism and white supremacy culture.
Yes.
And so he's like, dude, you got to check this out. It's blowing my mind. So what you just shared about having to move our bodies, in this current part, because I'm a slow reader, she is sharing how important it is for us to move our bodies as a way to embody learning and understanding.
I'm all for that. And you know what? While you share a fascinating book, I've just read, and I'm going to link it to, because I think it is in link with what we'll be discussing anyways. And it's The Body is Not an Apology by Sonia Renee Taylor. Mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. And I, too, am a slow reader now. And I don't read that much anymore. I listen to books. When I've discovered that, I'm like, I've never read so much with my ears.
Right.
Perfect. So, yeah.
Can I share something?
Please.
I just shared it with some students, some design students at MICA, Maryland Institute and College of Art in Baltimore. And it is a definition of liberation inspired by Sonia Renee Taylor.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. Okay, ready? Okay, let me find it really quick. Because I share, you know, definitions of oppression, of equity, of design, of liberatory design, and then liberation. What does that mean? So this is inspired by Sonia Renee Taylor and Aaliyah Iveson. And it goes, liberation is the sustained radical love of self and others nurtured in community through the design of objects, spaces, processes, roles, relationships, systems, and policies that together ensure all feel belonging and freedom to become what they choose. This liberation is felt in all six of our senses. So the five normal ones, and then, because multiple cultures include this, is intuition.
The future is bright when you read things like that. That's
right.
That's what we're into all this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So how do you go from being this kid that I, for what I hear, feels a bit lonely and to founding so many things, being interested in design, founding schools? Mm. What happened?
I feel so lucky. So a lot of things I contributed to this, what I recognize as deep privilege to be able to do all of these things and work with such incredible people. So let's see. One is my parents were deeply flawed. They did the best they could. And what I know is that they believed in me.
Wow.
Two, I have always been creative. It is how I came out and how I try to understand this world. And they saw that in me and they provided me all resources to try to get that shit out.
Mm.
And so I've had the privilege of having opportunity after opportunity to practice, whether it's playing drums, whether it's doing animation, whether it's doing BMX freestyle, whatever it is, they were opportunities for this creativity to land somewhere so that I would stay on this planet. Other contributing factors, I am a straight white dude. And I am the beneficiary of generations of legacy privilege. Mm. I have gone through a system, even though I feel like I survived the system. I survived it because it was designed to protect
me.
Right? And so failure after failure, I was always able to be picked back up by resources, by giving the benefit of the doubt, whatever it is. Being able to get away with it because a boy will be a boy, you know. And then...
Especially white.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and this was the 70s and 80s. And the other is the combination of creativity and privilege and rage. That, again, as a boy of the 70s and 80s, we were not trained, equipped, modeled on how to recognize our emotion, be okay with them, learn how to articulate them. You know, we're trained to squash them.
Yeah. Sure.
And squashing emotion can turn into rage. It can turn into violence. And it can turn into humiliating people, particularly women. And I did all those things. And being a deep empath, seeing how much pain I was causing people around me through that rage, it really wasn't until my early 20s when I was able to, once and for all, just be done with hurting people that I loved and figuring out a way to transfer that rage into something more productive. And that is looking more deeply in the mirror as to what's going on with me, David Clifford, where I come from, and recognizing there's so much pain, designed oppression in this world that I benefit from. And I can use all of the things that I mentioned earlier to try to continue to learn about myself and fight the power. One last piece. It is growing up when I did, being exposed to the hip hop that I was, you know, from Public Enemy to Tribe Called Quest to then, you know, Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Like these groups were formidable in developing my racial awareness, my class awareness, and gave my rage a place to go.
Mm.
So, and as a curious, creative empath, I feel that, as you can see from my eyeballs, like I'm also restless. So I'm always looking for something where I can work with really great people and learn about myself and, agitate. I consider myself a benevolent agitator. Right.
I love that. Yeah. So you went to high school, what brought you to design actually?
What brought me to design?
Are you a maker first? Would you say that? Like in the course of everything you've done, would you say that?
You know, I would say that. I would say making has, I think, precedes everything.
Yeah.
And it is, again, it has ground me through this life. My father was an amateur race car driver. I thought he was the coolest dude on the planet. And so just watching him and watching he and his friends engage in love and dialogue while they were building things to go faster, you know, and that was also a place where I saw unintentional intimacy between men. And wow. Joy between men, which I can talk about later with the boys' school. So yes, making from forts to, you know, my fabs sign to, you know, to models, everything from skateboard ramps.
Yes.
And it is what has brought me joy. And then discovering design in high school.
Ah, okay. And so you became what, a graphic designer or...
I went to an art high school, LA County High School for the Arts, which was mind-blowing, game-changing. And then I went to California College of Arts and Crafts here in Oakland in San Francisco to study product design.
Uh-huh.
But because of my values, it felt too capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
And I only made it a semester and transferred into jewelry metalsmithing, which is essentially product design, but intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there's a craft in everything people do.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
tell us about the school for boys. How did that come together?
That came together. I was, at the time, I was the department chair of the technical arts at a high school in San Francisco. And there we taught metal shop, so blacksmithing, machining, welding, design, electronics, wood shop, glass. It was cool.
Wow.
It's still around.
Yeah.
It's still around. And word got out that this dude, Jason Baton, he was teaching at the Julie Morgan School for Girls and wanted to start a school for boys. And at the time, this was, you know, almost 15 some odd years ago, there were very few maker spaces around. So people sought us out often. And so he sought me out. And I was like, dude, I'll help you. But it has to be, making has to be everywhere. It can't just be in the shop over there. The mindsets of making, the practice of making needs to be everywhere, from how we build the school to how we engage with each other. And so we met and I felt like he trusted me. He was not afraid of how weird I am, how agitating I can be.
It was celebrated instead.
It was celebrated.
Go where you're celebrated.
Yeah.
That's where we should go.
I do. I do feel that way, that I feel that I am where I am because there have been leaders around me who have believed in me and trusted me. And I know a few episodes back, you had Dr. Susie Wise on there. And
yes.
Susie's one of those folks that saw something in me, believed in me, and brought me into the D school. And the rest is history there, because liberatory design came out of that.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. From these folks wanting to change. And
Yeah. So anyway, so Jason and I got together and he had his crew and we wanted to redesign middle school for boys so that learning was irresistible. And so that it was a place where boys could be boys and be held accountable for being boys.
Interesting.
Through the lens of equity, social justice, creativity, and making and love.
And emotional intelligence.
Emotional intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. Learning all this and how you apply it and what it means. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
Wonderful.
So it's now, I think, in its 13th year. And that was a fascinating project.
And you're still involved in it.
Tangentially, I'm still involved as a founding member. But, you know, the true measure of a school's success is when the founders leave. And so I, as much as I want to be as proximal to that place as possible, because it is magical.
Yeah.
I also need to give it its space so that it can be its own thing. And, you know, it's what I've noticed, especially during and post pandemic, is that dominant culture, because of the pandemic, once again, has a stronghold on people's fear. And what that means then is that schools, whatever progress some schools have made around equity, around social justice, around social emotional needs of kids has gone back several years.
Really?
And this is just my observation.
But
I'm sure there are some people are writing about it. So that means that status quo expectations of school, so testing, you need to do well in math and language arts, et cetera. And granted, literacy is at an all-time low in this country, particularly for African American and Black families. And there's more to schools than that.
Yeah.
Right. Increasing literacy is critical, especially in marginalized communities. And we still need humans that are going to be creative, equity-centered, community-oriented, and have access to power in order to redesign the systems and policies. So when we are all literate, we all have access to opportunity. Currently, we don't.
Yeah. Yeah, and it will be needed more than ever with all the challenges humanity is facing. And so you need people who are critical thinkers. And for that, you need literacy.
Yeah. And also, you need people who are creative.
Yeah.
And curious. And sometimes creative and curiosity can be antithetical to critical thinkers. Or we've been played to think or conditioned to
think
that they're in opposition and actually they work beautifully together.
Yeah. That's an excellent segue to talk about your TEDx talk.
Okay. Okay, cool.
So you had, it was 2019, is that right? In New Zealand?
Mm-hmm.
I want you to just give us a bit of an idea what it was about, because to me, it leads towards explaining liberatory design as well, somehow. Mm. So it was about X-shaped people.
Yes. So an X-shaped person comes from the T-shaped human, which comes from the I-shaped human.
Yes.
The backstory to this is I was trying to start this school called Design School X, and X is the missing quotient, if you will. Maybe that's not the right term. And you are X. And in fact, there's on my arm here is this equation that I developed during trying to start this school, that if you follow this equation, it will lead to a school that is rooted in equity and creativity and belonging.
Wow.
And X plays into it. So I had this meeting with the funder. I'm dying to tell you who the funder was, but I will hang back. and this funder was considered the most innovative funder at the time, and came in with this idea of Design School X. And they were like, yeah, this is cool and all, but how do you know they're going to learn math? How do you know they're going to learn, right? I'm like, you're missing the point. Like this, we need to design for the future. And we have overturned the idea of American high school by looking at it through the lens of equity and creativity, and left that meeting just obviously with no funding and crushed. Like if this is the most innovative funder and they're still hung up,
doesn't get it,
then I don't know what to do. And this was another instance where creativity, like a beam of light came down and said, you need to work on redesigning the mindsets of people in education. And so we were playing with the dimensions of it was, let's see, learning about people's skills, their strengths, their story, and their stance. And I had hired, this is a long story, I'm sorry. I had hired some students of mine, some old shop students of mine, to help me out with the website and social media. And they did this graphic drawing and they're like, dude, David, it looks like an X. I was like, oh wow, it's an X. It's the X factor. And an X is stronger than an I, is stronger than a T. It goes deeper. So it then goes back to schools currently, for the last 100 some odd years, have been focused on developing linear I-shaped people, right? And really only focusing on this tiny part of the brain.
So, yeah. So what are I people, for people who know the, I don't know if it's a theory, but I people, T people, which led to you creating X?
Yeah. So what we found in all of our empathy interviews across generations, across the United States, is that ultimately what's at root is that most humans, they want to learn and they want to belong.
Mm.
And most learning contexts are not designed for that.
Mm.
They're for conditioning, assimilating, preparing, separating, and who we are as people is not important, because what schools were set up to do was to create humans for the factories.
Workers, yeah.
Workers, but through the lens of the designers, the architects of our school system, which were white men.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. So you need to strip everybody of their former beliefs, of their religion, of their family, so that you assimilate and are conditioned to the white Christian male
straight
way, right? And so that is what our current system is producing still to this day. And we can add DEI directors, we can add these various programs, but if they are not baked into the very culture and the very curriculum of the school or of our system, they become, again, Band-Aids.
Yep.
That when things get hard, you get sweaty, the Band-Aids fall off.
Yeah.
And we're back to white dominant culture prevailing. And T-shaped really then is still like an academia design approach where it's still linear, but yet the idea is that you can go deep on something and broad with folks, but it's still very white dominant. With the X-shaped, so at the base of the X are someone's story, which is their history, their lineage, and then the strengths, which are the things that we come with, our intrinsic strengths that light up every room, that we bring to a team, that we bring to a brainstorming session, whatever it is. Those are our foundation. Schools have worked, especially, I'm thinking about schools, the boarding schools for Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Those were designed to strip story and strengths away. So here, intentionally, we are thinking we need to acknowledge that people are not I-shaped. They are X-shaped.
Mm.
And we need to be able to see their story, their strength. We need to design tools and processes to learn those, to build from them. Because at the other end of one's strengths are opportunities to build skills. At the other end of one's story is a stance. Right. And that is what you stand for. And that's rooted in your strengths and your story.
It's your values. And it's what, guides you. And
yes. Yes. And that's your foundation. And what I also learned is that learning takes courage to be vulnerable, because you're stretching out of your comfort zone. And
beautiful.
If we take the time to, again, learn who's in the room, and it does take time, it slows the, was happening during the pandemic, learning lost. And so if we're always content driven, we are missing out on being community oriented.
Yes.
Right. And character driven, purpose driven. So at the core then of the X-shaped person is an opportunity, which I think what school should do, is an opportunity to find your purpose. Mm-hmm. And you have a term that's amazing. It's multi-potentialite.
So it's a term, and now I would want to say it top of my head, Emily. So she lives out west. I think she's from Montreal, and she wrote a book about multi-potentialite. And so we're not talking about just high potential or giftedness, or it's not just about that. I also interviewed a French woman who wrote a book about slasher people. They call it in French slasher. And it's like, you're a designer, slash maker, slash artist, slash lawyer, you know? And it's all about this idea that we're not one thing. We're all multifaceted. We have multi-potentials, and they will show up, rise up, be developed if the environment allows it, if mainly right. Culture, whatever. And throughout time, I'm not interested today in things I was interested in 20 years ago, but at my core is still about art. It's still about making. It's still about people, understanding people, getting together. It's the core is still that. Now, how I do that, it was through painting, photography, or event management at some point, and now it's merged. But yeah, so it's this idea that we can't be just one thing. It's about impossible. Emily Wapnick. Yeah, multi-potentialite. So you did the TEDx in 2019, and then Laboratory Design, you started to work with Susie Wise, that we talked about and I had on my podcast last year. Wonderful Susie. Tanya Annecy, Victor Carey, and John Malarkey from the National Equity Project. The basis is design thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we have had episodes about design thinking, and I will, of course, provide links to all this beautiful knowledge in the show notes. But why? How did that come? It's like an experiment, collaboration with a whole lot of you, and it's now something that we can use.
Yeah, it's really cool. Okay, so liberatory design came out of my time working on Design School X, DSX.
All right.
So Susie Wise invited me to apply for a fellowship at the D School, at the K-12 lab, to work on Design School X, to use design thinking with equity to reimagine American high school. So while there, it's an amazing place. And as an empath and somebody who's equity, social justice oriented, it's quickly apparent that the D School is lovely, design thinking is lovely, and it is riddled with whiteness and maleness and capitalism.
Gosh. All of,
all of them. They're all there. And I was like, oh God, no. Here it is. And design thinking is so awesome, and the D School is awesome, and the people here are awesome, and we are perpetuating all of these. If we continue to practice design thinking without taking a pause to notice and reflect.
Yeah.
And again, this is where I'm leveraging my creativity, my agitation, and my privilege. But at one point, so 2015, like, fuck it, I'm gonna try something out. There are these hexagons, empathize, et cetera, et cetera. The hexagon and that visual, by the way, was designed by Thomas Both. I was like, I'm gonna hack it. And so I added notice at the beginning to pause and think about who we are as designers, especially myself. I was trying to hack my own behavior. How am I showing up as a white man? And it's pausing to notice my identities, my values, my beliefs, all of which impact how I empathize. So if I'm not paying attention to who I am, and most white men do not pay attention to who they are, because we don't have to. I really wanted to intentionally slow down to reflect on who I am, how I might show up, based on also who I'm going to be empathizing with. And then also noticing, too, that design thinking is very extroverted and is moving at a pace that's tied to capitalism as well. And so I then added reflect at the end of the design thinking process to slow down and think about how the process is impacting me, how I'm impacting the people I'm working with, to slow it down, to also to reflect on my learning. And then learned that Victor Carey and Tom Malarkey were exploring design thinking at the National Equity Project. So Susie connected us, and in some ways, like, the rest is history. So Susie, Tom, Victor, and I, and then we brought in Tanya Annecy, and that was it. It was over. We then started to play with the location of notice and reflect. We brought in playing with the design thinking mindsets to make them more equity oriented, to ground the design work. And originally the process was called, before working with the National Equity Project, it was called equity-centered design thinking. And then when we started collaborating, it was called liberatory design thinking. And then as we were trying to move away from, interestingly, from its origin of design thinking, we dropped the thinking. Because again, the thinking is still privileging the brain. And we're really hoping that liberatory design was an embodied practice.
Wow. Okay.
Right.
How do you describe it? If someone asks you, what's that? How do you describe it?
So how I describe liberatory design, it is a process and a practice to ensure that we are not baking our biases into what we're designing, to ensure that we are working, we are including those that are impacted by the design problem into the design process. And we are working to challenge, and this is where it starts, people start to cringe if they haven't already, is in every design decision we're making to really examine, be curious about, critical about how oppression has been baked into almost everything that we do. That it's a way to design to ensure that people's humanity are considered. And that the design outcome was collectively made, really privileging those that are most impacted by the design as a way to ensure that we, again, are designing for everybody's liberation and humanity. And my room here is covered with all different kinds of ideas, but I have over here an area where I'm starting to jot down designs or products that have eroded community. And of that list of things that have eroded community, what they all share is convenience, consuming, and ultimately capitalism.
If people have difficulty understanding the use or the pertinence of design thinking, if you add the equity part, if you add the let's look at ourselves, you know, let's name those privileges, how do you apply it? How do you bring it to life to organization or company?
It's so complex. You know, it's interesting. So for people who are not bought into design thinking, you know, what comes up for me is often being in spaces of color, being privileged enough to be in those spaces. Often design thinking is seen as a very white sport.
Interesting.
And we as white people are the beneficiaries of racism, of slavery, of the genocide of Native Americans in both our countries. So it's there all the time. And I think that's an important part about liberatory design. You know, I don't use design thinking. I don't use that language anymore because it is too easy not to consider equity, social justice, and oppression as we're designing, especially as a white person. And I know there are designers all around me who do not want to use liberatory design because often they can rest their laurels on their liberal, progressive sense of themselves. There's a great book by Robin DiAngelo called Nice Racism, How Progressive White Liberals Perpetuate Racial Harm.
Right. I will put that in the show notes.
Ooh! It's a very important read. It will definitely make your white listeners uncomfortable. And I would say to those that are uncomfortable listening to it or reading it, lean in to that discomfort with
yes.
courage and curiosity and know that it's not personal. It's part of our conditioning.
I'm interested in how you apply it in these times where people are exhausted, stressed out.
And so, I mean, given everything that the context that you just shared, how do I sell people on liberatory design in an age when people are exhausted, when they already don't buy into design thinking, which is ultimately a creative practice?
Yeah.
A really cool creative practice, which, again, in my opinion, is not enough for the complexity of our time, but still, it is a great primer. I would go into the liberatory design mindsets. I would look at the challenge that you've just posed, and I would look at these. And when you say, you know, people are exhausted, I would go to one of the mindsets, which is attend to healing, the effects of oppression. And all of us have been oppressed and impacted by systemic inequity.
Yeah.
The effects of oppression are complex and often hinder our ability to take action, even if the taking action is to be open to other ideas. Integrate ongoing healing processes when designing for equity, it says here, but I would say for anything.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can flip it over. Oh, this one's amazing. This quote on the back, it's from Adrienne Marie Brown, and that it says that we all have the capacity to heal each other.
Yes.
And so knowing that as a designer, and again, I would say the parents are designers, knowing that as a parent, designing with or for your children, or if you're a teacher with and for your students, if you're baking in this idea of healing, of even healing your own trauma from schooling or your own trauma that is generations old from your family, imagine, right? It's pretty magical. And so lo and behold, we have a mindset called share, don't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an intentional dig at capitalism and design thinking, if you will, because it's in some ways the capitalist darling. And when I share, practice transparency and non-attachment when sharing ideas with people. Earn the trust of others through our actions, not just our words. And share as an opportunity to learn. So I'm not going to try to shove liberatory design down your throat. I'm going to use liberatory design to learn about you, what's important to you, and see if it even fits. Liberation was designed into liberatory design so that you can become the pollinator and adjust it for your context. So for that, I would then take focus on human values.
Mm-hmm.
What's important to you? I would also invite folks to work with fear and discomfort, which is another mindset. And then most of all, which is super hard in our binary time, is embrace complexity.
Yes.
Which is one of the liberatory design mindsets. Recognize that equity challenges, and everything is almost an equity challenge, are complex and messy.
Mm-hmm.
Stay open. That means be curious to possibility. Powerful design. Good design emerges from the mess, not by avoiding it. And so often we want to avoid the mess because we've been conditioned to perform, to be comfortable, right?
To not make waves, to not, you know,
And that changes too. I mean, when you say not make waves, here we are. You identify as a woman.
Yep.
I identify as a man. Making waves looks, the consequence for making waves for the two of us looks very different.
Sure.
Women have been conditioned not to make waves because it's an unladylike, or it's dangerous to the fragile egos of men.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Whereas I have been conditioned to be as messy as I want, you know, what is it? Move fast, break things. That's because I can get away with it. But if I was a man of color, the consequence for moving fast and breaking things is my job or jail.
And if you're a woman, even white, and you go fast and you break things, well, the slap's coming back quite quickly.
That's right.
You know, psychological harassment, all this is what comes in for us. And I think there are so many levels. And that's probably another new episode. But what I find very interesting is everything that you've mentioned are things that I am into. I've always been passionate about emotional development, interested in healing trauma. And for us, it's an obvious thing. Straight off at the beginning of the conversation, you described yourself, you talked about your anger as a youngster, talked about how you dealt with it, you went within, you dealt with your emotions. But this is wonderful, but this is still such only a few people will go there. So I'm thinking in our practices, in our work, we're asking people to do things. And I've had this discussion with so many friends, designers. I think that there's a point where it's unfair to ask people and your clients to be challenged, to change, to try new stuff if you've never done that for yourself. Because I think there are a lot of people out there asking that of their clients or collaborators, whatever you want to call them, but they have never been. So often I'm like, have you ever been to therapy just for fun? And like, why would I? I don't have problems. Yet you're going to ask people to jump in. And so I think there's a broader culture about investigating who you are and where you come from and why you inherited so many traits that might not even belong to you, to society, to your family. But there's a lot to be done before we can actually be comfortable with these principles of design. Do you feel that with the youngster kind of gels more, better? Do you find they're more open to it as practices? Or that might be ageism.
I think it's a great question because there are developmental stages that are appropriate or not in engaging the work. What's coming to mind right now is what my stance is generally in this work, and that my stance is one of an invitation.
Mm.
And it is generally speaking, for people, how do I invite their creative courage? How do I invite using tone, using visuals, using my dress, using my language? Do I button up my shirt to hide the tattoo? Do I leave it open? Like all of it, we're sending signals all the time. And it changes. So I've worked with kindergartners all the way up to graduate students.
Wow.
And except for fourth and fifth grade, I haven't taught. And each one of those, I show up as still the same sparkly ball of joy. What I'm trying to do is to model the vulnerability and the courage to be joyous in the work of self-discovery. As I get to learn about design, about the world, about other people, so that we can change how we are with each other. When I taught at a K-8 last year, I put the liberatory design posters all over the room so that you could see the images with the words. And, you know, a kindergartner is not going to be reading the words, but they're going to see the images and they're going to be making meaning from those. So it's in the space, right? You mentioned that earlier. What's the context that we're allowing this to happen? That's a context. You know, it's also me greeting them with love in my heart, belief in that they want to be them their best selves, because that matters. We transfer it when we connect. And so it is those moments, you know, and really for young folks, it's creating the context so that they can continue to build from their creative maker magical selves. And know that it is an important part of who they are, and to carry that through while also encouraging their core teachers to recognize that that's also critical, that creativity, design, and making is critical to our humanity.
And equity.
And equity as well, right?
Mm.
And I think so often there are people are either doing equity work or they're doing design work.
It's rare
to do the two, and they have to work together.
Yes.
Because ultimately empathy and equity are acts of creativity, and liberation is an act of creativity. You need to imagine the world that you want to live in just as you dismantle the one that you cannot live in. And that's from Ruha Benjamin. And then it changes. Come middle school, I think that is the beginning of the end, because they are so open and they're so critical of themselves, of everyone around them, their families, their friends, their teachers.
Yeah.
And that is, I believe, the moment to really have in front of adolescents people who are actively working on themselves in relationship to others, as Bruce Lee says. It's important to do is to learn about yourself in relationship to others, to model that, to model humility, to model courage, to model the courage to navigate the discomfort of working through injustice, through inequity, through immersion.
Together.
Yes. 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 And I think about myself, because many students have had women as teachers, because 85% of teachers in the US are women and mostly white. In these moments when, because I've worked in mostly independent schools, and so often they are white boys in these spaces, I have made it a priority of mine to be very conscious of how I show up as a white man, so that they can see that there's another way to show up as a white man.
Interesting.
And, you know, I'm covered in tattoos. I taught shop. I can build almost anything. I'm a fucking badass, right? And I'm not just a badass of making things and looking like a hipster. I'm a badass because I have worked for decades and daily working on reconditioning my own idea of who I am.
Working towards who you are now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By challenging all of these myths that I've been fed about my superiority.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I hope, because I know that you'll have some listeners who probably have hung up by now or who are ready to look me up. What I hope that they know is that by doing this work, it actually feels amazing. And it doesn't, you're not losing anything by challenging your power and your privilege. You're actually gaining a deeper insight into who you actually are and the beautiful people that are around you.
And how do adults, I don't know, corporate settings or people our age, how What do they react?
Again, it depends on the context. You know, in design settings, corporate design settings, they find liberatory design uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
In adult contexts that are very education centered and mostly of color, they're very critical of design thinking because, again, it feels very white because there are assumptions baked into design thinking about failure, et cetera. I think it's so interesting. It's complex. It matters on also who I'm co-presenting with.
Uh-huh.
That's,
how interesting.
Yeah, it all matters. So it's interesting. I feel so blessed and privileged to be working with an HBCU, which stands for Historically Black College and University on the East Coast, and have been asked to work with them to use liberatory design to redesign their school principal program.
Wow.
And, you know, we talked about like, okay, how are we going to name the elephant in the room that, you know, you brought this white dude in to talk about this equity-centered form of design? And that's a whole nother podcast. But even in that, it is me pausing to use liberatory design to use one of the mindsets, practice self-awareness, recognize oppression, work with fear and discomfort, share, don't sell, to really learn the context of this area, of this school district, of this college.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's going back to your question about how do adults take this in. My therapist recently said this as advice for working with my younger daughter. Sometimes it's not the message, it's the messenger. And so how then in this HBCU can I show up so that I have done my work and earning their trust the moment I open my mouth? And that means paying attention to and asking questions of what is the dress code like? What's the college, the university colors, right? What's the context within which this university was created? All of that, it matters.
That you adapt to them and not the other way around.
Exactly. And so often that is an assumption that design thinking and design makes, is that I am the expert designer. I'm coming in to extract this information.
Evangelists?
So
no, I can't. Yeah.
So, and I, as a learner, as somebody who loves to learn things, oh my goodness, just in this one project alone, I have learned so much about an entirely different organization, group of people, origin of the United States, and about myself.
Yeah.
And I'm better for it.
I mean, such a fascinating, and we can go on for another hour, I think. Let me ask you, what are your dreams? What do you see for the future, for your practice, or for the world, you wish?
I mean, I have a lot. One, I think about, you know, and I just shared this with some design students this morning on the East Coast, is, and sharing liberatory design is, I ultimately, our hope with creating liberatory design is that people take it up and it changes how they feel about themselves. And then therefore it changes their context, and they feel so good that they want others to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one. And the last thing people will need is to hear about design from another middle-aged white person. So when I am sharing it, I am sharing it from the practice of an invitation and gift. Like, I'm inviting you to try this baby out.
Take it up. Yeah.
Take it up. And if you like it,
hack it. That's so funny.
And just a quick side story is, with that, there are some folks in Brazil who are now working with us to translate it into Brazilian Portuguese, so that liberatory design can be shared in 900 schools in Brazil.
Wow.
Like, if that is not systemic change, if that's not pollinating for liberation, I don't know what is. It's beautiful.
It's very interesting, because Susie Wise allowed me to translate into French design for belonging, le design d'appartenance. So that's interesting, because exactly, it's, you pass it around. You see, how can I apply this in my family, in my school, at my work? So now I want to do the same thing with liberatory design. I'll translate it into French so we can spread the word.
Let's talk.
Yes.
And so I think a goal too is that, you know, that I am designing my obsolescence in every experience, every workshop, everything. And I hope
you
that
you program your obsolescence.
Yes.
That's excellent. So
that again, everyone sees themselves as a designer designing for humanity, and that, and then more specifically, that white people see themselves as capable and courageous to see themselves as culpable in racism and systemic racist practices and policies, and that they see that they are able to, with courage and creativity and curiosity, to make a difference. You know, that it's not enough just to read a book or listen to a podcast, but they can do it. And they have, because of our privilege, we can make mistakes.
So within friends, within colleagues, practitioners, we should be able to test our relationship to these issues. They're complex and they are uncomfortable and it is difficult. But willingness, I think, and open-mindedness can go a long way, because at the end of the day, you want to be kind. You just want to make a better world, isn't it?
Right. And sometimes it takes work and courage to be kind, especially when someone has a different viewpoint than you.
Absolutely.
And again, to pull up a liberatory design mindset, to practice in building relational trust. That trust is the glue that binds us through this hard work together.
David, thank you so much for this conversation. I give you the last word. What would you tell the upcoming generations about all these challenges?
You know, what would I tell them? What's coming to mind is is Mr. Rogers, and he would say that you are beautiful. And that I love you, and that you are perfect just as you are.
And important.
And important. And that you have inherited a world that is really fucked up. And there are multiple beautiful opportunities to be in relationship with yourself and the world, relationship with other people. And it takes courageous discipline to actually push out all of the chaotic, cacophonic messages that we're getting from all these sources and the conditioning, to really develop a discipline around whatever you care about. So long as what you care about doesn't hurt other people.
Yeah.
And I do believe this. I have this quote here: our single purpose is to grow our own capacity to love. And that's from a friend of mine, Bavu Blakes from Texas.
Wow.
And I would say it's our capacity to love ourselves and love each other and love our communities and love our planet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a wonderful interview. Thank you, David.
It's so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us today. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to subscribe to Innovent Korea on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Special thanks to Millimétrique, who composed my music themes. I encourage you to discover his music on Bandcamp. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.